It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get an update on what didn't make it into this week's legislative special session.
First, a blog on the Wall Street Journal today called Wisconsin a Saudi Arabia when it comes to frac sand. The domestic oil boom has made Wisconsin the national leader in production of frac sand.
Kristen Jones is the co-author of the Wall Street Journal piece, In Fracking, Sand is the New Gold. She's a member of iNews in Denver. Kristen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So we're talking about not fracking directly to get natural gas and oil in Wisconsin, but about the sand they use in it. Can you give us a sense of just how important Wisconsin has become to the frac sand industry?
Sure. Well, first of all, the frac sand industry is booming along with the oil and gas boom in the U.S. You know, even as natural gas prices have sort of languished and some of the air has been taken out of that part of the industry, demand for sand has just grown and grown. So energy companies are expected to use 56 billion pounds of sand this year.
56 billion.
And much of it is coming from Wisconsin.
Yeah, why Wisconsin? What is it about our sand?
You guys make great sand. It's bigger, it's rounder than sand that's coming from other places. It's just perfect for sort of keeping the fissures in the rock open so that the fuel can come out.
And what's the trend in the use of sand? Is it that as fracking goes to more and more areas, they're using more sand, or are they using more sand in each operation now?
Yeah, well, both. I mean, you know, fracking's definitely grown in the last few years, but what energy companies are finding is that if they put even more sand into each well, then they can boost production from the well. So they're starting to experiment with just using more and more sand. The chief executive of U.S. Silica told us that it takes 25 rail cars of sand on average to frack one well.
Wow. And speaking of rail cars, we're seeing a lot more sand travel by rail. Here's a quote that kind of caught our attention. That Canadian Railway, the company, is spending $68 million to restore railways in Wisconsin, basically just to facilitate the shipping of frac sand.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be transported some way, and rail is the most efficient way to do it. And so, yeah, there's been a bigger investment in sort of making sure those rail lines are up and running.
Are we competing with other states here, or is Wisconsin really the dominant player in frac sand?
You guys are pretty dominant. I mean, there are frac sand mines all over the country. In Iowa, there's frac sand mines in Texas. There's frac sand mines in, I think, in New Jersey. So they're everywhere. But as the industry progresses, I think the energy companies are becoming pickier and pickier about the kind of sand they want. And so they're turning more and more to Wisconsin.
And who are the players in this industry in Wisconsin and around the country?
You mean in the sand mining industry?
Yeah, as far as the companies involved in doing the mining.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few companies that are doing a lot of the mining. Uniman, U.S. Silica, those are kind of a couple of the very big operators. But you've also seen a lot of smaller companies that have gotten into the mix in the last few years. Because mining sand has a relatively low barrier to entry. I mean, it's hard to sort of start up operations as a fracker, but you can fairly easily, if you've got a site, you can start up operations as a sand miner.
Fracking around the country is not uncontroversial, of course. A lot of concerns about the environmental impact. Same goes for frac sand here in Wisconsin. A lot of local governments, local citizens in the western part of the state are worried about the health and environmental impacts. What kinds of developments are you seeing along those lines?
Well, certainly there's been some concern about the health impacts of silica on the workers themselves. I mean, we profiled a company called Pattison Sand that operates in Iowa and is starting up a new mine in Wisconsin that has had 775 orders and citations since it began operations. And a lot of them have had to do with overexposure to silica, to workers just being exposed to way too much silica. And silica, you know, it seems like sand seems pretty innocuous. You see it at the beach. You have your kids playing in the sandbox. But actually, crystalline silica, you know, the very small pieces of silica, are very dangerous to inhale.
We've seen some.
So there is some concern about health.
Yeah, we've seen some concerns to regulate the industry, moratoriums from local governments here in Wisconsin. What are you seeing around the state and around the nation when it comes to environmental protection or worker protection on the silica sand mining?
Well, one of the things that's happened very recently is OSHA tightened the standards for exposure to silica. Because, you know, what they've learned over the last few decades is that it takes a lot less silica than they originally thought to cause risks of disease, especially silicosis. So that's one thing that's happening. You know, you see less regulation when it comes to sort of ambient exposure to silica. Partly, I mean, there isn't an established threshold for what is an okay amount of silica to inhale if you're living by a sand mine, for instance. So a lot of the opposition has come from local areas, as you've seen in Wisconsin.
And we've seen that in Wisconsin. Is that that kind of local opposition, either from local governments or local citizens groups? Are you seeing that elsewhere in the country?
You know, you're seeing it again because a lot of the sand mines are concentrated in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. A lot of the opposition is also in Wisconsin, too.
So any signs of this sand mining boom slowing down anytime in the near future?
Not really. I mean, even, you know, as the energy boom has slowed in some ways, the sand mining industry has just continued to boom. And, you know, a couple of the companies, the public companies, have seen real profits from selling sand. Shares of U.S. Silica have doubled since it went public in 2012. Shares of Hi-Crush Partners have jumped 60%, almost 60% since it began trading in August 2012. So, I mean, you know, who knows? But right now it doesn't show any signs of slowing.
We've talked a little about environmental and health impacts of these mines. What is your sense of the economic impact that they're having in the sand mining regions?
I mean, you know, it depends who you talk to, but the sand mines are certainly draw attention to the amount of economic activity that's going around that comes from the sand mines. I mean, it's not only the mines themselves that are employing people, it's also the truckers, the rail industry, as you mentioned. So you are seeing an economic impact from the mines.
Kristen, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
That's Kristen Jones. She's co-author of a Wall Street Journal piece. It's called In Fracking, Sand is the New Gold. She's a member of the iNews team with PBS in Denver, Colorado.
Coming up, we'll find out about the stuff that didn't make it into the legislative special session.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. In the first year of Wisconsin's two-year legislative session, thousands of bills have been introduced in the State Assembly and the State Senate.
Only about 100 of those bills have been passed by the legislature. Only half of those have been signed into law.
So what's left for the remaining year of the current session? Well, we'll find out now with Bill Leaders, reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Bill, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here again.
So are you surprised that they got through so few bills?
Oh, no, it's not an especially unproductive session. This always happens that many more bills are introduced than become law. In fact, one of the primary functions of the legislature, besides passing bills, is to not pass them, to keep certain things from happening. And that is the fate of most legislation that gets proposed. There is about 900, between 900 and 1,000 individual bills that have been introduced so far this session. And as you said, only about 100 of them have passed the legislature. There'll be some more bills that pass in the coming session, but what I did for the column that I wrote this week is I just did a sampling of some of the bills that haven't passed yet and took a look at what they would do and where they are in the process.
Let's jump into some of those bills. One of the ones you mentioned has to do with smart meters. What's that legislation?
Well, smart meters are the devices that utility companies install in homes that have a wireless connection to their equipment that they allow to get the information they need about your energy usage. There is a concern that has arisen that this violates privacy and some backlash, and there was legislation that was introduced that would prevent utilities from installing these meters in the home of anybody who objected. And of course, some people are going to object. The utilities say, well, most of them are already installed. It's kind of a done deal. And also, it will cost lots of money for us to take these out. And also, we do have pretty strong privacy protections that this information would not be used or sold in ways that would violate people's privacy. So that bill hasn't gone anywhere.
I know that's something that has happened a lot in Madison, and there's some backlash against these smart meters. Is this something that's going on all over the state as well, and that's why supporters of this bill are getting
involved? Oh, absolutely.
Involved?
Sure. This is a statewide issue. It's a concern that's raised in certain quarters where people have a distrust of government and corporations and think that their privacy is imperiled by this technology. And, of course, the utility companies will argue against that. The opposition to the bill is fairly overwhelming. Of the lobby groups that have registered an opinion on this, I believe all of them have come out against it.
Well, another bill that did not make it this time around, it was a more recent one, a piece of legislation, wind energy suits, and people thinking about some of the damages that they may be incurring if they live near a wind farm.
Well, this is a really interesting bill because what has happened in the state of Wisconsin in the last couple of years, since Governor Walker was elected, is there has been a lot of legislation that makes it harder for people to sue companies if they think that their interests have been harmed. This is a bill that makes it easier for people to sue. If they live near a wind turbine and they feel that there are health consequences or there is a loss of property value, this would increase their ability to sue, would provide some attorney fee reimbursement. It would state as a matter of law that just being in compliance with all applicable laws would not be a defense against a lawsuit. It does cut dramatically against the grain of the what's called tort reform, which has swept Wisconsin. This bill has not had much luck getting out of the pack either. And again, the lobby opposition to it is fairly overwhelming. I believe 21 of the 24 groups who have registered an opinion on this bill are opposed.
And there's opposition within the Republican majority on this, right? Frank Lissay is the sponsor of this bill, and he's been pushing for it. But because of the tort reform issues you mentioned, as I understand it, a lot of Republicans aren't jumping on board with this.
That's probably the case. It certainly is not consistent with other actions that the Republicans have taken to make it more difficult for companies to find themselves in court paying out damages to people who say that they've been harmed.
Is this one that you would say has a good shot at moving forward next time around?
I do think that there certainly is support for it. It could move forward. It's one of those things. I mean, all it really takes is one committee chair who is against it to stop a bill. There's a lot of ways that a bill can be stopped, short of a veto from the governor, which is also a possibility in every case. This one here, it all depends.
So a lot of years in a row, it seemed like the top issue in front of the legislature were laws that said we should be able to hunt blank, and you fill in an animal there. Mourning doves was a biggie years ago.
Yeah, cranes.
This year, cranes, right. This year, woodchucks. A bill was proposed to allow a woodchuck hunt.
Yeah, it would create an open season on woodchucks. It would say that the DNR could not set a bag limit on the number of woodchucks that you could kill within the period of time that the hunt was open. This bill was introduced in April. It did have a hearing, but it has not advanced.
No bag limit. Do they usually in hunting bills set that kind of restraint on the DNR, saying you can't regulate the hunt we've created?
You know, you see that more and more, that the legislature is presuming to tell the DNR what it can't do. That's a big part of the proposal with regard to frac sand regulation, as it says the DNR cannot set stronger standards for frac sand mines and exist for other industries, blah, blah. It does. Again, that's another bill that constrains the ability of the regulator to regulate. I think we've seen some of that with regard to wetlands as well.
In terms of Democrat-backed bills that did not get a lot of traction, the Democrats were backing a slew, a handful at least, of gun control legislation. They proposed it, and it has not gone anywhere. What is the state of some of these, things like banning assault weapons and large-capacity magazines? Where are we with some of this gun control legislation?
Well, the one that the Democrats are most keen on would require background checks for most firearm sales. This is something that has passed in some other states. deaths, particularly in the wake of Sandy Hook and other tragedies of the sort. It has enormous public support. I heard one of the advocates say recently that the support for background checks in the state of Wisconsin is on a par with the support that people have for Aaron Rodgers. Both enjoy like 90% approval in the opinion polls that have been done. But this bill appears dead on arrival. The Republicans have not had hearings on it. They've not advanced this in any way. As I say in the column, the legislation regarding background checks, regarding assault weapons, regarding high-capacity magazines, and a bill that would prohibit the carrying of concealed weapons in the state capitol, which is not allowed, all have gone nowhere, which is expected to be their final destination.
Is this pretty common in when we make lists of bills that don't pass, the minority party advancing legislation that they know isn't going to pass, but they do it because it's their agenda, it's what they use to reach out to their supporters?
Absolutely. We saw that yesterday with the introduction of a proposal that the citizens of Wisconsin should have the right to vote on an advisory referendum on the question of redistricting. The Democratic lawmakers proposed that. They would like to see an advisory referendum on the ballot in 2014. I think it was the Associated Press today, or maybe it was the State Journal's article that just said, as a matter of fact, this bill has virtually no chance of passage. The Republicans who control the legislature have not even wanted to hold hearings on bills that would create a nonpartisan redistricting process. The idea of having a advisory referendum is probably not going to be embraced by the party, but it might be embraced by individual Republican lawmakers. That will be an interesting thing. Yeah, I think a lot of times parties who are out of power will advance legislation, will introduce legislation that they think ought to be law, even though they know that it's politically unlikely.
Is part of that it might sit there dormant and be used as a template later on when the party's back in power?
Yes. And a lot of times it takes years of proposing legislation before it gains the type of support that it needs. We saw that over the past couple decades with restrictions on smoking in restaurants and bars and things like that. That was legislation that was introduced many times and failed before it gained acceptance and passed.
You also write about some campaign finance law changes that that may actually happen, I think, campaign disclosure laws.
Yeah, there is a number of things that would tinker with our campaign finance system. The one that I think is most likely to pass is was actually introduced as an amendment to another bill. You can't find it in the bill itself, but there's an amendment to a proposed bill that would double the amount of money that candidates for most state races could receive from a particular contributor. It raised the maximum contribution for the governor's race, for instance, from $10,000 to $20,000. It would raise from the maximum contribution for a state assembly race from $500 to $1,000, for Senate from $1,000 to $2,000. It would double all these amounts. That, I think, does have a chance of passage because getting more money from contributors is something that has bipartisan support.
So we talked about a lot of hot-button legislation that didn't move forward, and then there was rubber duck races.
Yeah, rubber duck races. That, you know, I started looking into this thinking it was a joke, and most of the press attention that is received has taken that tone, that this is a funny thing. There's a proposal before the legislature now that would specifically allow charitable groups to have raffles and contests that people bet on that involve racing rubber or plastic ducks. And the more I looked into it, though, the more I realized it's not actually that bad of an idea. There are a number of charitable groups around the state that have had these contests that involve rubber ducks. Some of them have received letters from the Justice Department notifying them that this is not an approved form of gambling under our laws. And the law does have to change for these contests, these promotions to be legal.
In our last minute, Bill, you mentioned before we started here that you don't have to be the only one to dig up this information. You're trying to provide tools for people to be watchdogs on what's going on in the state government.
Yeah, that's very much one of the things we try to do at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism is to share the knowledge that it takes to do this kind of poking around. We just published this week on our website, wisconsinwatch.org. On the front page, you'll see a resource guide for watchdogs, a watchdog toolkit, and it contains some tips and some links for using some of the resources that I use to report these stories. For instance, a link that will take you to the page where you can look at all of the legislation that is introduced. You can drill down and you can see what the status of it is. You can look at the analysis that's been done. You can look at fiscal estimates. You can research the support that's received from special interest groups.
All right. Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
That was Bill Leaders, reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest about the rise in stay-at-home dads. He's part of that trend himself.
It's also time for Curious Wisconsin. We'll learn about a boathouse and Viking Great Hall on Rock Island.
We kid you not, if you have not already seen it, it exists, complete with runes, carved chairs, a giant fireplace. We'll hear all about that tomorrow. And we'll also talk about America's pest problem.
That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear about what's behind tomorrow's fast food workers' protest planned for 100 cities. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about the winter storm hitting Wisconsin today. It's the first big storm of the season. We'll get some tips from an emergency preparedness coordinator on how to get ready for the season.
First, fast food workers across the nation tomorrow are planning on walking off the job and staging demonstrations in 100 cities across the country.
They're calling for higher wages, up to $15 an hour, and in some cases, the ability to form a union. The protests are the latest action in a growing movement that started last year to put pressure on fast food companies.
Joining us now to tell us more about the demonstrations is Jennifer Epps Addison. She's Executive Director of Wisconsin Jobs Now. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you so much for having me, although I will say I'm a bit depressed that you mentioned this massive winter storm hitting Wisconsin just as we're getting ready to walk off the job.
Big storm coming tomorrow, that's right. Not so much in the southern part of the state, it sounds like, though.
Well, that's good.
Well, Jennifer, what's at stake tomorrow when workers go on strike in 100 cities, including Wisconsin?
Well, I'm really excited to be one of thousands of people across the country who are going to be joining workers in over 100 cities as they walk off the job and go on strike to demand $15 an hour and the right to form a union without retaliation. This is really about fairness, and it's about the type of economy we want to build for our country. I believe in an America where everybody who's willing to work hard has the chance to earn a fair and a decent wage and to take care of their family without being forced to rely on public assistance. And I am so very grateful to the brave workers who are risking their jobs and their very little amount of economic security they have to go out on strike, not just for themselves, but for everybody who wants to build an America with a once again strong middle class.
In the past, I'm thinking maybe the 80s, 90s, I think a lot of us thought that fast food workers were mostly teenagers looking for some extra spending money. Seems like that's not exactly the case anymore. What can you tell us about the kinds of people who are working in these restaurants today?
Well, sadly, it's absolutely not the case. I think that a lot of people, a lot of critics against the movement fail to recognize the new American economy, particularly post the economic collapse of 2008. We're seeing more and more college-educated people and older adults with families to take care of entering low-wage service work. And in the fast food and retail industries, that number is incredibly significant. In fact, the average age for a fast food worker is 28, and the industry is actually dominated by women. About two-thirds of the industry is made up of women, and the average age for women in the industry is 32. So we're not talking about teenagers here. We're talking about people who are getting up every day and going to work as hard and working as hard as they can. And when they come home, they're trying to figure out how they can make ends meet to take care of their family. They've got rent and to pay. They've got transportation to get to work, and they've got children that, just like every single American, they want to see have a decent shot at a good future. And that, for many of them, is out of reach with the poverty wages that these corporations who are extremely profitable, might I add, are paying.
Now, one of the numbers we've heard about a goal salary for fast workers is $15 an hour. That's pretty high. Is it unrealistic to shoot for a number like that?
Well, you know, for me, it's actually not high. One of the things that shocked me that I didn't realize is that actually back when Martin Luther King led the March on Washington, it was a march for jobs and freedom. And one of the things that they did is call for a raise in the minimum wage. At that time, it was less than $3 an hour. But if we adjust for inflation, then the amount of money that Martin Luther King back in the 60s was advocating for in his March for Jobs and Freedom is actually the same amount that fast food workers and low-wage retail workers are asking for today. It's a fair wage. It's a wage that allows all of these workers to continue to serve in our economy, an economy that sees millions and millions of visitors every single day to their stores, but it allows them to live independently so they're not forced to rely on public assistance. One of the most shocking things that we found out over the course of this campaign is the number of workers who are actually working as hard as they can and doing what they're supposed to do, and yet they earn so little that they still have to rely on food stamps and child care assistance and housing and energy assistance. And so, you know, we are taking a stand, and we are saying when you are a company with billion-dollar profits, right, like McDonald's Corporation is, that you have enough to pay your workers fairly and to pay them so that they no longer have to supplement their income by being forced onto public assistance.
Now, in Wisconsin, the minimum wage is $7.25. So if we're looking at 15, that's a little more than double. If that happens, would these restaurant chains be forced to raise prices or hire fewer workers? Is there an argument there that this could actually hurt the employees?
Well, you know, we haven't seen sort of the sky is falling arguments bear out in reality. When we look at previous increases to the minimum wage, we've seen there is actually an economic boost that happens to our economy rather than the other way around. The reality is that we have a consumer-driven economy, and if you put more money in the hands of folks who are going to go out and spend it in our local economies right away, you're going to boost the economy not just for those workers but for everybody. And so that's one of the reasons why, you know, we have had such slow economic growth is because these low-wage jobs are becoming a larger and larger part of our labor market. And the folks who hold those jobs can't then go back into their neighborhoods and their communities and their local businesses and do the shopping necessary to get our economy moving. So we believe that not only will raising wages to $15 an hour be fair and just for every worker in this country, but it will actually help to boost our economy and get it back on track to be an economy that works for everybody and builds up a middle class rather than just an economy where the wealth and economic opportunity are all concentrated at the top in the 1%.
In terms of people who, you know, make, well, not the $15 an hour they want, something more around $7 an hour, and then need help from the state, they need government, they need public assistance.
Absolutely.
Are you making the case that maybe this could actually save the state money?
Well, I absolutely believe so. I mean, right now, the reality is we're being robbed blind by multinational corporations who have extremely large profit margins. And nobody asks when the McDonald's CEO doubles his salary last year, when the board of directors and the shareholders are all making massive payouts. Nobody asks, are we going to have to raise prices when that happens? But the second that workers stand up together and say, we deserve to be paid fairly for the profits that we help the companies we work for make, all of a sudden we're being threatened that prices are going to be raised. The reality is that businesses will do what is necessary to continue to make a profit. So if they can pay their workers less and increase their profit margins, they're going to do that. But if we as a country and as a community hold these corporations accountable and we tell them that we no longer as taxpayers are willing to subsidize their poverty wages just so that they can increase their profit margins, then we're going to be at a point where we'll be able to transform our economy back into an economy where everybody has a fair shot to get ahead.
Now, to look at one of the companies you're talking about, McDonald's, as I understand it, they are a franchise organization. They have individual owners as going along with being part of, you know, the bigger McDonald's umbrella group. Do the individual owners have any say in what they pay their workers?
Well, they do have a say in what they pay their workers, and one of the great victories that already has come out of this year-long campaign is that at individual stores here in Wisconsin, workers are winning victories every day. So they're actually being given the raises that they've been promised for years but never received. We've had people who had been unjustly punished or fired who, because now they have coworkers and community members supporting them, have been able to address those grievances with their managers or with actually the owners of their franchise stores. And so I think it's already making a difference. But the reality is that corporate McDonald's take upwards of 20 cents for every dollar that's spent in a franchise store. It is, again, an extremely large profit margin. And so, you know, while we understand that there are some franchise owners that are struggling to get by, although here in Milwaukee, I will say we have some of the most wealthy franchise owners in the country, you know, we would encourage those folks to understand that they got more in common with the folks who are working in their stores than they do with corporate McDonald's. And if at any time any one of them wanted to stand up and say franchise agreements are not fair to the folks who are actually running the business in our communities, I would venture to guess that each of their workers would stand with them and say, you're right, corporate McDonald's should be held accountable.
Can you tell us about one or two of the people involved who will be, I guess, walking off the job tomorrow and what their personal life story is?
Absolutely. You know, we have such a range of folks who have been involved in this campaign. It's part of what I think really moves me. You know, we have leaders like Miss Mary, who's a Popeyes worker, and she's 56 years old, and she's worked at Popeyes for nearly 7 years. And, you know, at her store, she joined really because she wanted more dignity and respect. A lot of people lose the fact that this is not just about getting a higher wage, although it certainly is important, but this is also about having the dignity that a good job provides and respect in your workplace. And Miss Mary was being threatened by her supervisor for not working fast enough and for sticking up for other employees when they were being disciplined, and had gotten to the point where she actually had been threatened by her manager. And when we found out about this, not only did the coworkers in the store who had signed up on union cards, but also union members from across the city of Milwaukee and community organization members joined together and went to Miss Mary's store to negotiate a resolution to that conflict with her manager. So, you know, this really is about building worker power. I firmly believe that if you look at the greatest period in this country, the period that everybody looks back to and says that's the economy that we want to rebuild, that's the America that we were raised to believe in, it was an economy where there was high union density and where there was a huge middle class. And those two things are not to be taken in isolation. They're really correlated. And so we believe that in the fast food industry, regardless of whether or not we get to $15 an hour next year, every time workers come together and organize and find support within the community, it's going to lead to better outcomes in their lives. It's going to lead to them having more say in their workplace, having better working conditions, and eventually, hopefully, making a fair wage that lets them support their families.
We're talking right now with Jennifer Epps Addison about the fast food strikes that are expected to take place across the country tomorrow. And we'd like to know what you think about this. Do you support what these workers are doing? Would you like to see higher wages in the fast food industry or higher minimum wages in general? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up after the break. First, here's a look at some of the latest headlines we're keeping an eye on this afternoon. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation with Jennifer Epps Addison about the fast food strikes expected to take place tomorrow. And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about what these fast food workers are doing? Do you agree with their cause, or do you think there are other things to be focused on? 1-800-642-1234. And Jennifer, one of the critiques that is coming back from the National Restaurant Association information is that these demonstrations are basically engineered by national labor groups and that they're not really coming from the ground up, from the people working in the restaurants themselves. What do you say to that?
I would say that they should go and talk to the folks working in the restaurants that are going out on strike, and they would understand the power that people are feeling. I've been in on the ground floor of this, first as a community partner with a different organization who was just asked to support striking workers and didn't really know anything about what was happening or people's right to strike, and I had all the same fears and questions. And I've been so moved by what I've seen over the last year that I really actually decided that this is the passion that I have. I believe that this is a new labor movement for the new generation. And as an African American from Milwaukee whose mother and grandparents came to Wisconsin and came to Milwaukee to find a decent life working in the factories, I want to know what the path forward for my children is. You know, I'd like to think that my children are going to go to college and get great jobs, but the reality is that over 50% of the jobs that we're going to see in 2020 are going to be in low-wage service sector work. And so for me, the path forward for our country is to recognize that all work has value. There's dignity in all labor, and to value that appropriately by paying people fairly. I don't think that folks who make that critique, they want to dismiss it as being a part of national labor. Are there labor organizations that are supporting these striking workers? Absolutely. There are community organizations. There are churches. We saw less than a week ago the Catholic Pope, Pope Francis, coming out with a declaration on human rights and dignity at work and economic dignity. So this is a movement that is international in scope, but it is being led by the workers in these restaurants and in these stores who are struggling daily, making really challenging decisions, like whether or not they, eat that night because they need to get their kid to the doctor and they have to save up money for a copay. Do they walk the 2 hours that it would take them to get to their restaurant because they only got $5 in their pocket, or do they spend that money on transportation knowing that they may not have enough money to get home at the end of the shift?
All right, I want to get to our callers because we've got a lot of folks who want to sound off on this. Let's start with Scott in Delvin. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, thanks. Jennifer's a great spokesman, and I agree with a lot of what she says and support her, but as a franchise owner, it's a hard thing because I'm one of those franchise owners that my wife and I, we just do get by. And, if there's not a mechanism to say that the franchisors have to pay an increase in wages, it will not cost my franchisor a penny if minimum wage doubles. My franchise payments are off of my sales, and I will be paying the same to my franchise, except all my labor costs is going to double.
Right.
And it'll become strictly out of me as a small business owner's pocket. It's not going to hit the billion-dollar franchises at all.
All right. Thank you for that comment, Scott. Appreciate that. So, Jennifer, is this move just squeezing people who are struggling themselves and not really addressing, the big money at the top of the pyramid?
Well, I think that he makes a good point, which is, this action that's happening tomorrow is not about raising the minimum wage, although that's something I would support. This is about making those corporate actors who, right now, I would argue, are bad corporate citizens. Right, we support their workers by and large as taxpayers. We are, contributing and subsidizing their massive profits, and yet they're acting as bad corporate citizens, paying people poverty wages. So, these actions are exactly what the caller is hoping for, which is a direct affront to these multinational corporations and a demand that they start acting as good corporate citizens and paying workers fairly in this country. And, we firmly believe that if franchise owners were to join with their workers and were to start making the demand for fair franchise agreements from these billion-dollar profitable corporations, that we would be able to see some real movement. It would be, I think, a turning point in the industry.
All right. Thank you so much for that call. And we go next to Ian in Green Bay. Hi, Ian.
Hi.
Hi. What's your comment?
I work two jobs. I work in not a quick serve restaurant. I work in a sit down, and I have two jobs. And one is in woodworking, and I work less in the woodworking industry, which pays me significantly more than I do in the food service industry. I sweat every day. I work really hard in the kitchen, and I come home, you know, really dirty and exhausted. But in the woodworking, it's, you know, feeding pieces of wood into the machine, and I get paid significantly more when I work harder in the kitchen and make less money. And I feel exactly what you're saying. I agree with her totally 100%.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing your story, Ian. I appreciate that. Jennifer, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I think you mentioned the caller was from Green Bay. Is that right?
Yeah.
So there's actually going to be an action tomorrow. I'd like to encourage you to go tomorrow to – there's an action in front of the McDonald's. It's at noon. You know, folks can feel free to contact me if they want more information. But you should go and meet the other people in your community that are standing up and telling those same stories. It's both – disappointing as someone who believes in the value of people's labor, but not surprising because we hear it all the time. And in fact, McDonald's released a budget this past year to its employees to help them budget their money. And within that budget, while it didn't account for the cost of food, it did account for workers needing to maintain at least two jobs in order just to make ends meet within McDonald's own budget. So there is wide recognition that nobody in this country can survive on $7.25 an hour, which is the Wisconsin and the nation's minimum wage. And it's time that we stop talking about doing something and we join together as a community and we actually demand, as I said, these corporations to become good corporate citizens.
All right. Thank you for the call, Ian. And we move next to Rich in Woodstock, Illinois. Hi, Rich.
Thank you for taking my call. I can appreciate what your guest is saying, but I'm a public high school teacher, have been for 33 years, and someone who's been through a number of different unions and including and, have, you know, been involved in watching what's going on with respect to unions in Wisconsin with respect to teachers, I think something to consider when everyone's saying we got to give the workers rights is the union power will attract people who are attracted to power just like you get in corporations and in governments. And what I've seen is unions, once they have exclusive control in a job situation where they have all employees have to join the union and are not given the right to choose to join the union or not when they decide to work someplace, once the unions have that control, the power corrupts just like absolute power always corrupts, and unions stop working for the workers and they start working for the existence of the union alone. And I think you could see this in Wisconsin with how many teachers decided not to join the union. And people could say, well, if they lost benefits. Well, but if you're committed to the cause, then you would join.
And all right, Rich, so I'm going to stop you there because we're running out of time. Jennifer, do you want to respond to Rich? Is there undue influence of unions here who might have more than just the fast food workers on their mind?
I mean, we're talking to workers. It was their choice and their call to action to form a union. I mean, we really came and met most of the workers that initially went out on strike a year ago by talking about minimum wage. It was the workers themselves who said, yeah, raising wages are important, but here are all of these other issues that we really need addressed. They were the ones who came to the decision that the way that we do that is we form a union and we act collectively together. So I think that, you know, your union is like anything else. It is what you make of it. And these workers are building a union that wants to organize and wants to see a better America from the ground up, not just for themselves, but for everyone in their community.
Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Jennifer Epps Addison, the executive director of Wisconsin Jobs Now.
Coming up next, we'll talk about what you need to do to get prepared for the winter weather that's hitting some of Wisconsin now and the cold that's coming up later in the week. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.